those who are students of communication, listening, and trying to get something across from other people tell us that there are presently 600,000 words in the English language, in our way of talking English. And it's growing all the time. There are more words. We're picking up more words than we're dropping. You know, as we're younger, there's always words dropping off, but more words are being added. So it's growing fast. The average educated adult, let's say high school, maybe college, but probably no more for college, the average educated adult uses in the neighborhood of 2,000 words in one's vocabulary. That's usually those are the basic words that you operate with. I mean, that's the range of your vocabulary, certainly lots more in your specialization. But the same adult, for communicating every day, uses mostly 500 words. The words we rely on every day to get across to other people are 500 words. And the strange thing is that these 500 words have, in the dictionary, 14,000 definitions. So we're sort of set up for not being able to hear one another, or to communicate one another. And even lots of these words that we use, for instance, the very crucial word is, doesn't have any meaning. Small words in the English language do not have meaning. Only people do. And sometimes they don't. It sort of sets us up, it seems to me, for the difficulty that's involved to listening to someone else. Well, let me do another thing. We were listening to the room. There were no words being spoken. And yet, as far as I'm concerned, the room was speaking to us. And we were really speaking to each other, I suppose, during that process, too. I tried to look at people during that time. Again, the same people who study in this area tell us that communication between human beings is dependent only 7% on the words that we use. I get these figures right. I always turn the last two around. And 56% of our communication is on the nonverbal stuff that happens. Our stance, our appearance, the way we move, all of the things that are going on around us are the major part of the way we communicate. And 37% of our communication process is on speed, tone, loudness, pauses, all the rest of it. So really, this 14,000 business doesn't have to hang us up that much. We don't have to know all these words. We don't have to be cognizant of all these all the time, because really what's going on is listening to the nonverbal stuff that's taking place, and also being aware. I'm not asking you now to get to the point where you're always watching everything that's going on, but that is crucial to, it seems to me, the understanding of the communication process. I'd like to ask you to participate in another exercise for a moment, and then I would like to share with you what I understand listening to be about. And then we'll do some more exercises where we try to work at that, if you don't mind. I need 3 volunteers for the next thing that we're going to do. The first person ought to be somebody who has strong feelings about anything, any one thing that you can think of at the moment. Can be hopefully not related to somebody else in this room or be in trouble, but strong feelings. If there's something you feel very strong about and would be willing to participate in a very brief, like 3-minute exercise with somebody else, I'd appreciate it if you volunteer. Is there anyone who has a strong feeling about anybody, or are you all not strong feelers?
I will.
Will you really? Hey, great. You have a strong feeling.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is it possible for you to, it could work with anywhere in this room, but it'd be difficult for you to do it up there. Could you lay that down and join us just for a minute? Okay, thanks. 2 other volunteers, they don't have to have strong feelings. Anyone would be willing to participate in something with Barb up there? Yes. Okay, what is your name?
Eric.
Eric, Barb, and Eric, a third person who's willing to volunteer.
I'll volunteer.
Okay, good. Barbara, I want you to be in a place where both Eric and what is your name?
Dave
can see you. You want to come up here? Here, the assignment is this. I want you to share with the people in this room the thing that you feel strongly about, whatever it is. Just share with them, somehow get across to them that thing that you were thinking of when you said you'd volunteer. Whatever that is, I'd like you to do that. And I want Eric simply to help her share that with the people in this room. Okay? And Dave, your job is to be the observer of what happens between them and what happens in the room. And then afterwards, we'll talk about this exercise. All of us will talk about it, okay? Barb, you're on for a couple of minutes. Try, do your very best to share with us the things you feel very, very strongly about. And Eric, you're free to help her in any way you want. Okay, go.
Okay, I strongly feel that the United States is economically too involved in other countries of the world, and I feel like this came out in the coup in Chile, although it's debatable, but whether the United States corporations were involved there or not, I really feel like the multinational corporation is too powerful in the world, and that American companies are too often involved in the political arena of other countries.
Eric, you want to come up here? Okay, fine.
Should I say more?
Go ahead, share with us.
Oh, okay. Well, am I trying to convince them?
You want to share it. You want to convince them? That's your job. What are you to say?
Well, for example, what the situation in Chile was that most of the copper that was being mined in Chile was being exported by American companies. And politically, the government that was in power began to take over the companies. And I think there's evidence that the American companies were reluctant to give up their companies or their factories or give up the power in Chile, and that they had a part in overthrowing the government. And I think that wherever American companies are involved in the economy of another country, they're going to want to have some political power in that country as well.
Okay, we'll close the exercise at that point. David, what are your observations about this brief exercise? By the way, now, no longer am I interested in multinational or Chile or any of that business. All I'm interested in now is what happened in the process of Barb trying to share with this group something that she felt strongly about, okay? That subject you can take up at a forum another time, okay? All out, only we're interested in the process, okay?
Well, I think she's a little nervous about starting it. Well, I think I could feel like she was broken for information, try to think of something to say. She has definite feelings for this subject.
Okay, now you're telling me quite a bit about her, but not so much about the process. What happened? Do you think people heard what she said? Do you think that they? I'm not asking the people to tell you whether you heard it. I want to know whether he thinks you heard what she said.
Well, I think the people around her heard her. I know about the people way back there. They might not have heard her because voice wasn't really projected.
So you think there may have been, in the process, there may have been a difficulty of hearing her because of sound. Okay.
Of sound.
What else? Any other observations you have about whether people heard her, listened to her, caught sharing?
She knew gestures or tone was about the same throughout the whole process, seemed like to me anyway.
How about Eric's role? You can be blunt. We promise to protect you. Did Eric help?
Well, I think he helped by showing a visual help, which helps a lot to give projection around the room. That's why I like a visual thing will help with somebody else in the back to see more clearly.
All right. Let's open up to everybody. What did you think about the exercise, and how did you feel about the process? Yeah, go ahead.
I thought her tone was very good. She did it slow, and she didn't get on a soapbox. She didn't get vehement about her subject. She didn't stand there pounding her point of view. It was just presented.
Okay.
It's interesting. I react just the opposite to you. If she would have really got mad, I would have plugged in. But she wasn't mad, and I didn't really feel a lot of conviction. Plus, I felt detached because I didn't know anything about it, in a sense, you know. And Rich's plug-in, I think, was totally distracting for me. Eric's, I'm sorry. Eric.
I think she lost a lot of her conviction by no reaction.
From
the people that she was seeing. there were no reactors, so she lost a great deal of steam.
Okay. Anybody else?
I was really caught up in what went on between Barb and Eric, because when I thought about helping Barb say something, I guess I would have done it verbally. And I was simply impressed that the help wasn't verbal.
Okay. Now let me ask you another question. What do you know about Barb now?
She's a sweet person. Well, she put herself.
We do know that she'll risk, right? Okay.
She isn't afraid to give an opinion.
Okay.
One sort of analyzes her also as a debate opponent. And in a short period of time, you realize you knew something about the subject. And if you took her on, it might be kind of tough for you.
In other words, you had some impressions or feelings about her skills as a verbalizer.
Right.
Okay. Someone else.
She was more knowledgeable in the situation than a lot of us are. From what she's saying.
Okay. How do you know that?
I thought that maybe she had done some kind of a thing on okay. this, whether it's a term paper or whatever it is, that okay. she has really gotten herself involved in this a lot okay. more than a lot of the rest of us.
All I was asking you a question about was the comparison. All you could say is that you do know she knows something about it. There may have been 30 other people in the room who know more, but you don't know yet.
True.
Right, okay.
Okay.
Right, that's
I reacted
good.
The opposite. I reacted that she was speaking in generalities.
Okay. So your feeling may have been that she's faking it a little bit. She's got something, but she really hadn't dug in. Huh? That's a part of a piece of communication. Isn't that neat that we're there in about 3 feet of each other and felt or heard or listened two different ways to the same person, right? What do you know about Eric?
Nice guy.
Anybody? What do we know about Eric? What did Eric tell us?
I feel he's very expressive.
When
he's speaking to you, he can be very expressive with his hands or his face.
What led you to say that?
Well, because most people that are expressive do something like that, you know, have a visual aid help.
Okay.
I think he's supportive without interrupting and taking over what she was doing, but remaining in the background.
I think he also has a kind of assurance in what he does. He doesn't have to be forward or dramatic.
Once again, what, thank you for that, I'm pushing this along. What was, in your opinion, Barb trying to share? Right. That's what she was asked to do. She was not, in my opinion, trying to share information about Chile or multinational things. She was really trying to share her feelings. I guess I have to be blunt, I don't think Eric helped share her feelings. He helped draw a picture about South America, I assume, I didn't even look. But he really didn't help, in my opinion, Barb do what she was asked to do. Now maybe that's because the assignment wasn't clear, or maybe it is because that's the way we usually work, is that the thing that really was essential were pieces of information from Barb, and if she had given us enough information, then we would have known how Barb feels. I guess this time I would have preferred verbal, because I'd like to know why she's bugged by something way down in Chile. How come? What's in her that does that? Is she a show-off? Does her dad work for the federal government? Is he a CIA agent? Was she bitten by a Chilean chihuahua? See, all of that would have given me much more of insight, things like that would have given me insight into the feelings of where Barb was coming from. But we played the pretty normal game of information in the listening process. And there are times when it's crucial, you know, when they give you instructions on how to use the parachute, you better darn well listen, you know, you got one chance. But there are other times when what is going on in the listening process is not too dramatically dependent on whether or not you got all that information. Let me tell you what I think, as again, my definition to say it as well as I can, about listening is. It's first of all that you are determined to have someone else have what you have. Might be a feeling, it might be information. There is something that you're trying to get over to that other person. That seems fairly easy. But that secondly, it seems to me, you are anxious to be aware of what the other person is experiencing as that person listens to you. And possibly thirdly, that you want to enjoy the exchange between them. I don't mean sit there and clap or be happy, but that it's a satisfying kind of an arrangement between the two of you. There are all kinds of things that get in the way. We could spend the rest of the hour talking about obstacles to communication, the things that turn us off, the things that move us in different directions. But I guess I'd rather ask you to participate in a number of exercises for, you know, maybe 15 minutes, and then spend the rest of the time talking about those exercises, okay? So what I'm going to ask you to do now, if you would pair up with one other person and sit close enough to that person so you could talk directly to that person, see the person's face, see the person's eyes, sort of what Rich Cameron was talking about this morning, maybe what we ought to do is just look at each other once in a while, and that's what I'm going to ask you to do. And I repeat what I said earlier, you don't have to participate, you can do anything you want, I hope like mad you do, because that'll make it lots easier on me if you do. And I'm going to ask you to converse with that other person using a variety of restrictions about your conversation. And in the process, I want you to be very much aware of what's going on, very much aware of yourself, how you feel, and aware of what the other person is doing. Now, you don't do this all the time, but in these exercises, I'm going to try to turn you on to do that for a while, to be very self-conscious. What's going on inside of you? How do you feel? And what are you doing? And what's going on in that other person? How do you sense what the other person is doing? You certainly can do it with your spouse if you like. I take no responsibility. But you're welcome to do that. Or with one other person. Would you do that now? Get into pairs.
Yeah, what do you mean?
For a certain period of time, I'm going to ask you to simply talk with each other in a very normal way about any subject at all, and just be as normal as possible in the conversation. Just talk with one another. Again, be aware of what's going on, of what yourself, what's happening to yourself, how you feel about it, and what the other person is trying to do to share with you. Just for a short period of time, talk to one another. Okay? Right now. Go. May I have your attention again?
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to ask you now to sit quiet in silence and think about what happened just now. Just reflect on the experience that you had in talking to this other person. How did you feel as you were talking to this other person? I'm not asking you to say a word, just think about this. What did you talk about? Who started the conversation? Who chose the subjects that you got into? What were you aware of in the other person? Do you think that you really talked to that other person or simply used words?
Did you have eye contact? Was there any physical touch involved? Now I'd like you to do another exercise. This time I'd like you to converse with each other for a short period of time again with the following restriction. Each sentence that you speak must be a statement that begins with the word it. No questions are permitted, no questions at all, only it statements. In other words, and you must alternate word sentences. In other words, he would start out with a statement that says it, whatever he wants to say, and then she has to respond with a sentence that starts with the word it and respond. And then you alternate back and forth and converse on the basis of simply it statements, no questions, okay? Go. Talk to each other that way, right now. Now I'd like you to take another very brief period of time and talk just freely with your partner about how you felt about that exercise. If it was difficult or easy or what, not only was it tough or bad, but how did you feel inside as you tried to do that exercise with that restriction? Share for just a very brief period of time with each other how you felt about doing that, okay? Right now. Now I'd like to do another exercise, talk with that other person. Again, a restriction. This time, your conversation must be made up of statements, no questions allowed, which begin with the word you. Each sentence must begin with you. He starts off with a sentence, or one of you starts off with a sentence, says you, and then finishes the statement, no question, and the other person responds with a statement that begins with the word you, and you alternate conversing in that way, each time beginning with the word you. All right? Go. We're going to move right on to the next exercise right away. This time, I'm going to ask you to converse with each other, but the restriction is that you use nothing but questions. Ask one another a question, and you must respond. You must alternate back and forth, but you must respond with a question. The questions that are asked cannot be answered other than you might want to answer them through another question. But someone leads off with a question, the other person must respond with a question. All you can do is ask one another questions back and forth. All right, understood? Okay, go. The next exercise is built on that one. I'd like you now to recall as much as you can the questions that you asked as you conversed. But now I'd like you to turn them around from questions into statements. For instance, if you said to the person across you, why do you part your hair in the middle? You would say, I notice you part your hair in the middle, or something like that. See if you can recall. The other person might help you recall some questions. Then again, alternate saying something to the other person which transfers a question you ask into an I statement. The statement must begin with the word I. All right? Recall questions at your work. And if you can't recall too many of them, then do some other I statements to the person. But the sentences must begin with the word I. They cannot be questions. That's a restriction. But try and recall the questions you were just operating with. Please, go. We have two more left. This one, now you can, again, talk with each other, again, alternating sentences as much as possible. And you can say, talk about anything you want, any kind of sentence you want, except the restriction is that somewhere in the middle, you must have the word but. Talk with others, take turns back and forth. You say a sentence, as long as somewhere in the middle of that sentence, somewhere in that sentence, the word but. You don't have to start with the word but somewhere in the middle of it, you have to use the word but in conversing. Then you take turns back and forth, okay? Go. The last exercise. I'd like you to converse with each other in sentences again, but again, somewhere in the middle of the sentence, the word and must appear. Somewhere, that you talk about anything you want, no questions, just talk to each other, and in the middle somewhere, the word and must appear. If you can, recall some of the sentences you just used with the word but in it, and see if you can use the word and instead of but, and see what it does to the message that you tried to get across when you use the word but, okay? But you aren't limited to those sentences. Talk to one another, somewhere in the middle, alternating, somewhere in the middle, the word and must appear. Go! A little bit about your experience in these exercises.
But again, I'm going to review for you what I think are some of the, you know, what's going on in the communication process, especially in the listening process. First of all, I'd like to say this. I didn't say this earlier. You have something of substance that you want to share. You want to make the other person aware of. What you do, you don't just give that to the other person. What you do is you encode it. You put it into symbols like words or touches or feeling. You put it into encode. And you send the code across to the other person. The other person doesn't receive that substance that you wanted to get across, but receives your code and must decode what you have encoded before the person gets the substance of what you have. And so if there's difficulty with your encoder or his or her decoder, you know, the substance never gets over to where you wanted to be on the other side. Or to say it another way, to what extent are you making the other person aware of something that you are aware of in the conversation? To what extent are you able to understand what the other person is experiencing? And to what extent do you feel committed or connected with this other person and involved in his or her experience as it's going on? That, again, would be a review of what I think is the listening process to one another. Now, I'd like you to reflect on that in terms of this experience we went through just now, all these exercises. I listed here on the board. First, you talk normally with one another. Then you had to do it statements. Then you were asked to do you statements. Then questions. Then, as much as possible, turn those questions around to I. And then using statements with but in it and using statements with and in it. For instance, which of these were you least comfortable with? Which made you most uncomfortable? Which it'll be different for different people, of course. Yeah?
I think in our dialogue, the use of the word it and the use of the word you, we found ourselves really being phony. We could insert it, not grammatically correct, and just to get it in.
I see. Okay, so that one you played games with because it was tough. Okay, so that made you uncomfortable, you said. How about somebody else? Which was most uncomfortable for you? Or you can repeat the same thing, but I'd like to hear from as many as possible. The questions. What bothered you about that? What made you uncomfortable?
You want to answer the first.
Okay. You wanted to respond to what that question was and you weren't allowed to. So that made you uncomfortable.
We had lots of problems with but here. Some were negative.
Okay. So but was a problem. All right. Anyone else?
We had more problems the farther it went along because we begin finding out more information about each other, more things that we don't know. Finally, even though and is a relatively easy thing to put into a sentence, by the time I got to that last exercise, we had to throw it out.
And now, did that process make you comfortable or uncomfortable when you're at the end? In other words, you were saying there were so many things happening between you, the exercise lost their meaning, and then really something, some communication was taking place. Do I hear it correctly? Interesting.
Where we bogged down was in the translation of the question into the I.
I see.
The question was relatively safe to deal with, you know, in terms of just asking questions of each other, but when you had to reverse it and make those questions into a positive statement of affirming, it's a whole different
bag. All right. Of the list again on the board that you just experienced, which was the easiest for you? Which were you most comfortable with of all of them? And it's comparative, obviously.
Normal.
Yeah. The normal one. You were. Okay. Let me make a few comments about the kind of thing. Please. Go ahead. The and one? The and one felt good. Okay.
I think when you use you too, you can, if you don't know the person, you want to ask the questions instead of saying something about them. You
right.
are, or you will, or
right.
you do. You want to question
first. Let me just run down a couple comments, and it picks up on what I want to say too. And I'm just, and then ask for your response to that, to these. When we did the it things, you externalize it. It is odd sitting here talking with you means probably I feel uneasy talking with you here. But you'd say it and you externalize and put it out here and you distance, you place distance between the person here. And as soon as I start using the word you, the tendency is to either attack or put her on the defensive. You look comfortable, and then you say, no, I don't, I'm not comfortable. So it pushes it over in the other direction. In other words, it's usually trying to get rid of the responsibility of the conversation by pushing it in the other directions. In fact, I think most you statements are also I statements in disguise. If I say to you, you are lovely, what I probably mean is, I like you, I want you to stay around, I need you. But I don't tell you about me, I push it off onto you and say, you are lovely. And avoid my involvement in it. Okay? Question business is, of course, I think, as you said, is another way is to get the burden of the conversation over on the other side, because I lay it on you. Why do you wear socks like that? Which says, I think wearing socks like that is stupid. I don't say that. I ask you why you wear socks like that. Most questions are not requests for information. Most questions are not. Most questions are ways of hiding. For instance, the wife comes home from work and says to her husband, when's dinner going to be ready? I hope you understand that does happen. What is being asked? What's being communicated?
I'm hungry, let's eat. What have you been doing all day?
Right. A whole raft of things could be said. How come you haven't got the meal ready? For crying out loud, I'm home, you know? That could be. Or it could be, hey, have I got time to go out and do something in the yard? Could be. Could be, I'm hungry. Could be a whole raft of things. But you don't say that. You say, when's dinner going to be ready?
It's the tone of voice.
And, right, the nonverbal stuff and the tone, the loudness and everything else would tell you what's going on. But the question, really, the word, when is dinner going to be ready, really says nothing or very little until you know the whole of the context. Questions are usually the way we hide from our I statements. That's why you were asked to turn your questions into I statements. Most questions are I statements. I'm hungry would be a way to say it. I want to go and work in the yard. Or I'm mad because you haven't got dinner ready. Those would be the I statements, possibly, and others that are behind it. Okay? And then we did the but statement. But is probably the most destructive word in the English language. Sometimes it's a connect. Yes, please.
Before you get onto that, I want to talk about the I thing. And that is, are you talking about normal conversation, or is this, let's say, maybe you were counseling with someone?
No, I'm talking about normal conversation.
Mm-hmm. If you were counseling with someone, that would be a different thing.
Yes, there'd be other dynamics going on because of the setup of the relationship. Okay. I was talking more of mutual relationships, and often in the other, even though they have mutuality involved, there is a sort of a dependency relationship, and I think it tends to be different. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. But is a destructive one. Sometimes it's connective. But most of the time, it's a neat way to erase either what the other person has said or to what you had just said. Someone says, well, I think that the government is really making some strides forward. And the other person says, but don't you? But means, the heck it is. I really like the way you said that, but... Erased. It's a comfortable, polite way of saying what you really mean. Well, and another way to say it more drastically is, it's hiding from communication, from being heard. You really don't want to be heard. You want to be nice. You don't want your feelings to be revealed. You're afraid, probably, that the other person might hear you. And so you say, but. The and statement is the other way around. The government is doing a good job. You may or may not agree with it. But if you can agree with that, you say, and it's still a long way to where the other. You see, that doesn't cut out the other person. It may include him in. Now, you may disagree with it. You can say, I disagree with it. That's the way to do it. But if you don't disagree, but you want to add something to the perspective, the word and puts the connection together. Yes?
Isn't it in something like what you just said possible, too, that the and might also be a way of hiding a but?
Could be. Yeah, right. And that's where you'd have to say, that's why I'd end up saying the most fruitful way of hearing and listening, or talking and listening to another person, are the I-you statements. And now we're talking about, you know, two people talking, and probably in the group here too. I think earlier you started, I was going to use the illustration, you started with a question and then turned it around and got yourself involved in it. You said, isn't it, but don't you think, I think it was, don't you think that, and then you said something, I forget what the question was now, I lost it, I wanted to hang on to, but then you turned around, all of a sudden you had yourself involved in the statement. But you started out with a don't you think. Most don't you think statements are saying, I think. And then, so I think it could possibly do it, but the IU is normally the best way. I like being here with you. Is involved, it lays me out and it touches me with you, it's something that's happened between the two of us for that kind of communication. There are loads of times when you're saying, well, you can say, I think Holden is great, you know, that lays me out, but if you're really looking for a response, you finish it with saying, you know, how do you feel about it? That question, if you really are. I'd like
talking
to
about the phrase, don't you think,
yeah.
I've noticed in the past few years there's been an increasing use of the phrase we're talking about this other night, you know,
yeah.
In every sentence, particularly by young people. Mm-hmm. And for some reason this is a pet peeve of mine. I've used the trend of their thought by the continual repetitious use of the phrase you know. What are people trying to communicate by the use of that particular phrase continually in their dialogue with others?
Let me take your question and just ask you, what do you think they're trying to do?
You know.
I think they are trying to get your acceptance of what they're trying to say, and they almost do it unconsciously. But they, to me, in communicating to me, they lose me by using this too often in their communications. And I notice that adults now have picked up this you know phrase.
Okay. Anyone else got a response to this?
Don't you think? Sometimes people say the don't you think also to sort of set the pace. I think that it means the you know is the same feeling of don't you think. Sort of trying to get people to feel the same way but not knowing where they stand. So you say you know or don't you think.
Okay.
I know that. I say that. I don't know how much. It's probably an unconscious thing, but I do it because I want to make sure that you understand me. And if you don't understand me, you know, if I say you know, I just said, if I think that you don't understand me, then I want to re-explain myself to make sure that you do understand what I'm trying to say.
Do you think that's really what it is, or isn't it just a habit?
It's a habit.
It's a habit that just goes into the conversation. And oftentimes, I consider the younger ones started, or at least that's the way I found it out. And it was more of a peer group type. And it's sort of they did it, and it was sort of setting themselves away, you know, in that part.
Can I stop us again and call attention to what Barb just did?
What did I do? Hands.
Question.
Or what?
You said, you really think it's that, or do you? And really? Really what Barb is saying is, I don't think it's that. I think that it's this. So Barb cushioned you by asking a question again. So again, the communication was there, but it wasn't as direct as it possibly could be. And maybe there are times for that. You know, I'm not saying you got to do it only some way. But again, I thought there was an example of she was sort of being nice to you, but she didn't want to come straight out and say, I don't think it's that, I think it's this. And that's perfectly good. That doesn't mean you're right. See, we're talking about a language of acceptance. It's a piece of the way of accepting it. Acceptance does not mean agreeing or approval. It simply means I accept you and where you are and what you're trying to say with me. And that's perfectly good to do. Then my response may indeed be that I believe you're dead wrong, but I'll tell you that. But our language that cuts you off or doesn't allow you to sense that I do accept you even though I disagree with what you're saying is one of the harmful things in couples and marriages and just lots of kinds of things like that. And my goal would be to move from where we are to a language of acceptance. I think listening is fun. I think most of the time we don't listen. I think we can work at by some ways of being conscious of the fact that there are ways of signaling to other people that we do accept them and that it's worthwhile to continue the conversation. Tweet.
Asking this question here a while ago about don't do things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman whom I deal with some who asks that question perennially. And I've never gotten enough nerve to say, no, I don't think that, but you do. I mean, now maybe there could be a kinder way of saying it, but essentially that's, you know. Because I don't even know that she knows that she's doing it.
Correct. And the only way you will ever know is to tell her. And therefore, the degree of mutuality between the people that are conversing is, you know, will govern the ability of those people to get to be honest with one another. Our imagination of where other people is usually at least distorted, if not dead wrong. It's at least distorted until we hear them. When we have heard them, in direct statements usually, and then not always, but usually, then we have a sense of where they are and we can respond to where they are. Until that has taken place, usually, not a great deal has been shared back and forth.
May I share a cartoon where a couple were leaving a marriage counselor and the husband said to the wife, now that we've learned to communicate, shut up.
and it may be the first direct communication they ever had.
Right? Yeah. I have a question relative to but.
All right.
In communication, we've been talking for this period of time that you turn people off if you say, no, that's wrong, that they quit listening to you, and that you shouldn't say, yes, but. Now
I would disagree with that. Yeah, I would disagree with that because both of those avoid your involvement in it. You see, that's wrong is externalizing. It's like the word it. I take responsibility by saying, I don't agree with you, or I don't believe that, or, you see, I'm involved, or I'm having difficulty with that. I've talked about it and all that kind of stuff. But as soon as I involve myself, I'm not trying to put you down or the issue down. I'm trying to continue the conversation with you. Or some other sign that says, I accept you, but the subject matter, the issue you are on, the substance of what you're trying to get me to me, is one that I have difficulty working with, working on, accepting, whatever it is. But that signal for me, you know, and I'm not saying every sentence in all the world must begin with the word I, but somehow I communicate my involvement in it rather than that's wrong sounds like some dictum from where out there and a big moral judgment has been made. And the normal response is defensive. I don't, you know, that's it. Or if you say you're wrong, again, it pushes over to the other side. I don't believe that. I have difficulty with that. In other words, and I don't mean watering down, but bearing responsibility for one's own judgment and laying that out in the conversation. Normally is a very helpful to the communications process.
This does not turn off the listener.
Well, it depends again on the degree of the mutuality. You see, if it's like this, if people are working at each other like this or like this, it's very difficult to do it. I talk about mutuality in terms of trying to come at each other like this. And probably the closer you are, the more of that difficulty they can stand. If it's out here in a group like this where we really don't know each other very well, we have to find ways of saying where we just still bear it, but it's difficult to be that blunt about it. The objective of intimacy is to be able to share all kinds of pieces of communication, even the ones that are tough to take, including maybe shut up.
I have one other question.
Okay, I want to close it off because I promised them at 10:30 I'd let you go. So I want to thank you for being here and appreciate it very much and still allow you to ask your question, okay?
Apparently tax collectors were viewed as having no conscience, and they may have been right. In the eyes of most, they had sold out on their own nation. They were greedy, grafty, and available at a price. And so, obviously, Jesus associated with them. On another occasion, another tax collector, Zacchaeus, caught the Lord's eye. Zacchaeus was fully aware how much he owned and how dishonestly he got to own it. And obviously, Jesus had dinner at his house. Commercial fishermen aren't exactly the cream of society, at least they weren't then. So obviously, Jesus picked his most intimate associates from among them. Christ readily and obviously took the side of the woman, quote, caught in the very act of committing adultery. What was different about all this was not simply that Christ believed in forgiveness and the religious establishment did not. Forgiveness was a keystone of most religious thinking of the day. The difference was that while the Pharisees accepted sinners after they shaped up and proved their worth, Jesus accepted people as they were and where they were. The message of Christ is God welcomes sinners. The message of others was God welcomes people who repent. That's no small difference. The latter demands life. The former gives life. Religious people often try to out-God God, it seems to me, in our eagerness to identify, stamp out sin. We often miss and minimize the obvious, quote, God loves sinners. Jesus calls the outcast, not the respectable people. And please note, in this text, at least, he does not call them to repentance. He calls them. He calls them to himself, into himself, to the kingdom, into the kingdom, to life from death. And it is his call that changes them, that leads to repentance, to the recognition of their human predicament, their need and dependence on God for help, for newness, for life. Accepting the unacceptable is the business of God. Calling the outcasts mark the life of Christ. Obviously. There's a corollary to the outcast insight. In fact, it's essential to an understanding of accepting the unacceptable and loving the unloving as well as the unlovable. Jesus put it this way, go and find out what this scripture means. I do not want animal sacrifices, but kindness. Again, we face the temptation of trying to out-God God. We want checkpoints for religious fervor, tests of religious commitment, spiritual hoops to jump through to prove our religious obedience. The people of Christ's day were betting their money on worship ritual called animal sacrifices. What happened down at the religious shop, the temple, is what really counted. They thought, if you observed the religious ritual, followed the established procedures, you were in. Rather than a sign of a worshiping heart and a committed life, religious ritual became a substitute for human compassion, an alternative for mercy, an excuse from kindness, a reprieve from love. Jesus did not say that animal sacrifices were out and kindness was in. Rather, he said there are priorities, and kindness is one of them. Because of his understanding of God and his faith in God, and because of his understanding of man and his faith in man, he could not let those whom he met be less than human, less than they were meant to be by God himself. And so kindness came in all shapes and sizes in Jesus' life among and for the outcasts. It meant healing when sickness was in control, food when the crowd traveled a long way, helping a befuddled beggar along the road. Kindness meant calling a spade for shifty questioners. It meant defying prejudice, asking a Samaritan woman for a drink. Kindness meant teaching that forgiving a neighbor, a friend, or a spouse is a lot more than a mathematical formula. Kindness dealt with gut issues, things that really count in human existence, and it didn't matter whether they were at a particular moment things of the body, mind, or spirit. Kindness meant improving the human condition for the moment and for eternity. So obviously, kindness is important, more important than worship, than ritual, than Bible study, than organization, than fundraising, than numbers, than survival, more important than doctrinal formulations, which is not to say that any or all of these do not have their rightful place, but never, underline never, at the expense of kindness. Obviously. But to remain obvious, we must say that we're talking about the because of kind of kindness, the human kindness that is possible because of divine kindness, the love that loves because of being loved first in Jesus Christ, the respect and concern for humankind because of God's being sold on humankind, the commitment to improve the human condition personally and corporately because of God's commitment to improve all situations by everything at his disposal and therefore at our disposal. Christ's sacrifice on the cross makes all those other sacrifices less important than kindness. Because he lives, we not only can live, we really are alive with his determination to give people life in all its fullness, the kingdom. And the nitty-gritty lessons, I suppose, are equally obvious. Christians in the organized church ought to be primarily known for whom they hang around with. And they ought to be people close to the outcasts of society. Down and out, depressed, criminals, uneducables, rejects, way outs, left and right. The deformed, the ne'er-do-wells, the prejudiced, the cocky, the hard hats, the liberals, the short hairs, the long hairs, the no hairs, the adulterers, the whores, the drunks, the addicts, political heroes and political hacks. That seems especially important right now. The stubborn on welfare and the stubborn making millions, lonely children and lonely aged, the helpless stupid and the helpless PhD, liberated and unliberated, females and males, destructive communists and destructive capitalists, the emotionally enslaved and the emotionally free, people as they are and where they are. And the second nitty-gritty is like unto it. Christians ought to be known more for kindness than for buildings, for helping the poor than for liturgical services, for healing than for writing, for feeding than for arguing, for love more than being right. God, how we want to be right. For listening more than for preaching. For losing more than repressing, for hoping than for giving up. I wrote some applications of that to Holden, but I decided not to use them. Those are yours to do. Obviously. Or maybe there's still need for the simple instruction of our Lord, go and find out what this scripture means.
I'd like to take you a little bit behind the scenes first to see how you can get uptight about doing vespers at Holden. I started thinking about the kinds of people who are here that you try to reach when you do a vespers, and I made a list. Endless almost. There are guests and staff and faculty, of course. There are children as well as experienced citizens. I can't say senior citizens. High school crew, young adults, very young adults, gals, fellows, married, non-married, college grads and not so college grads, worldly wise and worldly dumb. Plus Methodist, Evangelical Covenant, Roman Catholic, Presbyterian, and a load full of Lutherans, besides those who are tired, and those who may, strangely enough, yet be alert, those who are eager, and indeed those who are bored, warm friends of mine, and yet distant strangers, people who have heard me preach before, and people who still like me. And even my very own family, spread like spies in your midst. One of them with his eyes on his watch to see how long all this is going to take. Well, I said, the heck with it all. I don't care about all that. I'm going to do my thing. However long it takes and wherever it may hit, I suppose that either a rationalization or an act of trust in God. As we read the text from the 12th chapter of St. Luke, the 32nd verse, these words: "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father is pleased to give you the kingdom." Strangely enough, the sermon tonight is organized. You may even be able to follow it. There are two sections. The first has five fairly brief comments on it, and the second section has one long comment. At least that's the way it's here on the paper, and let's see if it works out that way. Comment number one. Or first, the first part. Jesus said that our Father is pleased to give the kingdom. Comment number one. Jesus spoke for the Father. This was the beautiful and annoying part of Jesus of Nazareth, it seems to me. He was, on the one hand, a persuasive and able communicator. The poor people, downhearted, little guys in society, heard him gladly. Partly, I suppose, because he hung around with this kind of people. He didn't play down to them, he met them where they were. And partly, I'm sure, because he wasn't talking through his hat. What he said, he lived. But I'm sure speaking for the Father was annoying, too. He claimed he wasn't speaking for himself, but for the Heavenly Father, and I'm sure that turned plenty of people off. Those who didn't write him off as just another rabbi, there were plenty of them, you know, were tempted to assume he was some kind of a kook, hung on himself. And it took the whole of his life, of his ministry, of his suffering, of his death, and especially his resurrection, to get people to grab on, to accept. We call it believe, that the God who had spoken in times past in a variety of ways to the fathers by the prophets had really and positively spoken in these later days by his Son. So Jesus spoke for the Father. Comment number two. Jesus said, the Father is pleased to give you the kingdom. A better translation, I think, is that your Father has determined to give you the kingdom. The Father was dead set to put his creation back into shape, to let God be God again, to let nature be nature, to let man be man again. And further, the Father is determined not to let us miss the opportunity of getting in on what's been done for us. He's a serious lover, a determined seeker after men. And that's why, in our darkest moments, in our times of greatest temptation, God is closest to us rather than farthest from us, as we have often thought and even taught. The Father who didn't spare his own Son but offered him up for us all isn't going to let us blow it. Jesus revealed a determined Father. Comment number three. Jesus said the Father is determined to give the kingdom. Now here's where a lot of us are theologically uptight. It's still more difficult to receive than to give. We like the big shot role, we like to give. We are slow to receive when the receiving is really significant. You let somebody buy a hot fudge sundae in a snack bar, but let somebody lay down his life for you and see how it feels. And that's why so many of us are beating our brains out trying to make ourselves look good by style, accomplishment, look, Protestant work ethic, or what have you. He moves in on each one of us, even at the same time, with love and care and help, and pulls together those who have ever been and those who are